Welcome to Table Talk. I'm John Jones, and I'm joined by Grant Howitt.
Hello! Today's the big voice episode. I'm coming to you all the way from Brooklyn.
Celebrity voices impersonated. And Ben Turner.
I'm just watching my accent being horribly murdered by you guys.
Hello, welcome from Melbourne.
What do you mean your accent? It's my accent as well.
Oh, yeah.
From England. Yes, and also we have John Jones, who's doing the introduction. Say hello, John.
Hello, I'm in Sacramento.
John is literally American, but doesn't let it come through his normal voice. And John has a question for us about pole arms.
I do, yes. Since we're going to be talking about combat tonight, I thought it was apropos that we speak about what your favorite pole arm is.
My favorite pole arm is obviously the halberd, because it's the best pole arm. It's an axe, and it's a spear, and you can use it to put up curtains. And in Warhammer, you've got +1 on the first round of combat, and if you fought properly, you only needed +1 on one round of combat, which was the first, because after that, everyone was dead or running away. I just that's cool. So that's my favourite. What about you, Ben?
You see, I think halberd is the only pole arm. I think all the other pole arms were just made up to try and add some sort of colour and variety. Every system you play, pole arms are all exactly the same, and the eventual kind of except for maybe not spears,
pikes.
But yeah, pikes same as halberds. I guarantee it. They just all play the same. They're all D10 damage.
Pikes.
All D10 damage.
pikes are absurdly long.
Like, oh, that's right. Yes, pike is the one where you get some advantage in combat and then you'll go down to the dungeon and yeah, good luck with that pike.
Pikes are best used against mounted people who are really rare to find in dungeons, I've found. They hit the heads.
It's true, but I guarantee your players will pick an unpronounceable pole arm and then for the rest of the session will go, I'm going to slice him. I go, is this a pointy pole arm or a slicey pole arm? They're like, I don't know, I just picked this pole arm. So yeah, make sure you know your pole arms before your players get the better of you.
The Bilbeck Guadish de Guizan, which is like the crow's beak.
May we.
It was designed to yank men off horses and then you shank them up a tree once they're off the horse. It's just a big hook.
The halberd's the best. It's got the pointy thing, it's got the choppy thing, and it's got the hooky thing. It does everything.
So two for halberd. Yeah.
Yeah, it's honestly, it's the Swiss Army knife of pole arms. What about you, John?
I think mine would be Naginata, because I just like saying Naginata.
Naginata. Tell us what the Naginata is.
Naginata! I just remember it was from Oriental Adventures, you know. It was
did it do D10 damage? I bet it did D10 damage.
I don't know. I can't
remember.
It just sounds cool. I mean,
is it just a whacking great spear?
I think it's basically like a Japanese halberd.
See, you've proved my point. No one knows what the pole arms are. Honestly, it's basically a halberd.
John, I just looked it up. It's just a Japanese halberd.
it's got like a nice blade at the end, and it's a long pole arm thing.
Yeah, no, it's fair. It is very much, one of those things. Anywho.
So, making combat more interesting, that's what I think we'll talk about today.
This was my topic that I put forward. Now, this is supposed to be a podcast about all kinds of tabletop gaming, but I don't do all kinds of tabletop gaming. I only do role-playing, and I only really GM these days. Something which I find hugely important in my games and in other games I play is how to make combat as exciting as possible, because it's supposed to be exciting, you know? It's blood and guts and running and screaming, and all too often it comes down to, roll to hit the guy. Okay, you miss him. Alright, I'll come back in 25 minutes for the next time I roll to hit and miss him. Which is incredibly boring.
Absolutely. Like, combats typically take, hours sometimes? What's good in-game time?
What's the longest combat you've ever been in, John?
Oh, God. Probably, I'll be honest, I didn't commit it to memory, but it was probably 4 or 5 hours. And in terms of game time, when you're thinking, that's probably 15, 20 minutes tops.
What was the system?
It's just insane. I think it was D&D.
Okay.
Yeah, I've had the 3.5 edition high-level D&D was just a mess of stats. And I think... I used to play with a group. It was about an hour's train journey, and I had an hour to research all the stuff and get the adventure ready. I spent an hour reading up on this combat. We arrived. It was a massive slog. It wasn't very interesting. It was lots of dice rolling, big fire spells, doing 20d6 damage going here and there. And at the end of 4 hours, they defeated the combat. It was a minor encounter, a skirmish in a town where they get a small clue at the end. And they said, right, see you next week, guys, and went home. Awful.
Yeah. And it's... one of the first role-playing games I ever GM'd is a game called Wushu, which I've talked about on the podcast before, which is a very, very clever system. It's pay what you want. The designer, Dan Bain. I think I'm Dan Bain's biggest and possibly only fan. Well, definitely his biggest fan. I've never heard of someone talk as much about Wushu as I have. He just released a new edition called Wushu Black Belt. And the core mechanic behind the game is this really simple D6 system. But if I say, I shoot the guy, I get a D6. And if I say, I draw both my guns and shoot the guy, I get 2d6. And I draw both my guns, leap sideways through a plate glass window and shoot the guy, I get 3d6. And for each detail you put on, you get an extra dice. And you're encouraged to... It's solely there as a means to get everyone describing cool actions. You can also... It doesn't have to be like super cool Max Payne shit. It can be, I hide behind the wall, call for backup, and briefly soil myself. And you're as mechanically powerful as the guy jumping through the window. But that was the first thing I played, and so it was the first thing I ran, and I just got it. I understood what was going on, had a really good group, and we all understood what was going on. It was super fun to play and super fun to run. And then I went and played Dungeons & Dragons 3.5. It was a game of Slain, if anyone's read that. So I think it was 2000 AD.
Yeah, really, really good. I love the game of Slain.
Cracking comic book. Unfortunately, the Bronze Age barbarians don't really translate so well across to D&D, and we spent an awfully long time rolling separate hide and move silently checks. Then we got ambushed by Romans, and I remember I'd spent I think about 17-20 minutes waiting for my turn. I was like, cool, I heft my bronze great axe, yell a battle cry, and charge into combat. I'll taste your blood tonight, and missed. And he's like, no, it bounces off his armor. Okay, right. And it's just...
Wah, wah.
Yeah.
Sad trombone.
And it's like... It's partially my fault because I set up like, you know what? Narratively, this is obviously important, but mechanically, there was no means of making that blow important. So I shouldn't have dolled it up so much. But it did teach me that actually Dungeons & Dragons is a pretty boring system to have combat in unless you are pretty smart with it.
Well, that actually leads into a couple of things that I've always kind of fought with and to try and get into games. And one is, players, trying to get players to describe what their roles mean. A lot of players I've had have sort of rolled, oh, I got a 14, and they've looked at me like, now make that exciting for me, please. And I'm like, it would really help if you could kind of, if you felt able to sit there and go, oh, I heft my sword, I swing it, I slash across his neck for 3 damage, and I'm like, oh, awkward, he's actually got 100 hit points. So the whole neck slash thing probably isn't quite right.
And crucially as well, like the traditional relationship between the GM and the player is the GM has all the cards and the players are just there to kind of experience the GM's world, which is bollocks in my opinion. But from that, players often feel quite cautious in saying, yeah, I do this really cool thing and affect the world in this way, because they'll all have had a GM who go, no, you don't. And it's just this massive block in the middle of play.
No, absolutely. And I was thinking what you were saying with, what was my point now? I was trying to think of something that's tied to Fate Core. But yes, with Fate, I get a lot of people... Fate's very good for being able to describe what you do, but I still get a lot of people go, oh yeah, I jump in, I swing the axe, I say, die, Roman, and I try and trip him to the ground. I'm like, roll the dice first. if it's a handful of minuses, you might want to rethink what your narrative description looks like. So that, again, it does encourage players to describe it, but it does kind of try and reinforce, get your dice on the table and then maybe come up with a good plan.
Yeah, that's quite a night and day. I mean, did you immediately go back to Wushu, Grant? Just go, like, that's so much more satisfying.
Listen, that's the interesting thing about Wushu, is it's like cocaine, in that it's really satisfying immediately, and then afterwards you realise that it's just, like, it's... Eddie Izzard had a really good description of comedy versus theatre, and that comedy is like cocaine and theatre is like a full meal. And if you look at more traditional campaign-based role-playing games, you sit down and you have a level 1 character, traditionally, And then you've got a load of room to expand. If you think of the different routes that your character can take in Pathfinder, for example, you know, there's no limitation on what sort of level you can take. And there's a huge amount of routes you can take through the world. So you can start off as level one bard and then go into barbarian and go into battle scald and go into sorcerer and go into all sorts of things. And you have this massive story, which is mechanically reflected in your character. Whereas Wushu expressly contains no rules for advancement. Mm. So your character starts out badass and stays that way. And there's not really any room in the system to do it. So in that first session, you do everything you wanted to. You have that awesome scene, which is normally you have to save up and spend an entire campaign getting badass enough. And then in a Wushu game, you have that. And so I haven't run a Wushu campaign that lasted for more than four sessions, because everyone kind of gets everything they want out of their character by the end of that session. And so it's a different tool, and I can certainly, it taught me things. It taught me about describing play, and that being evocative and describing things. And no matter how long your combat's been going on, no matter how boring you feel, no matter how tired you are, if you step up and you deliver something, then that's important. Also, one other thing I want to say is knowing when to stop combats. Which I just realized there. All too often, combats just go to the death, and that doesn't really happen very often in films or in any of the media which we consume, which, you know, support our beloved tabletop hobby. But quite aside from that, pacing is such an important part, and not just pacing in terms of mechanics or pacing in terms of narrative, but pacing in terms of your night. So if your players show up at 6:30, you're not really going to start until about 7:30, because one guy's going to be late and everyone else has got to get, someone's got to level up their character and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And can't really play past 10:30 these days because, you know, we're all old. we've got families to go to and, you know, kids to look after, in your case, John. And you've got about 3 hours max. And if combat takes an hour minimum, then if it's basically a foregone conclusion that the players are going to win, just have the enemies run away. I'm always impressed at how few people think of this as an option. But it doesn't actually matter if the players don't lose another 7 hit points, but you save half an hour. That's cool. The guys surrender. It's actually more interesting to have a group of enemies surrender than it is just to kill them. Because then it's like, well, what do we do with these guys? Do they have any information? Can they tell us anything? If we kill them, then we're ultimate badasses at that point. Can we kill them to sacrifice it? Kill them to sacrifice the power of a spell? Can we steal their clothes, etc., etc., and go in disguise rather than just take their pants? It creates an interesting quandary, and also it's much more human, I think, for the enemies to go, you know what, actually, you're really good at this. What do you want? Knowing to stop when they're fighting, necessary, and knowing when your players are getting bored and when your players are getting tired of it, it's like, oh, actually, you know, this fight is already over. We're just going through the motions. Just cut it. Don't be afraid to cut it. Be my first piece of big advice, aside from describe what's going on, which is a bit vague.
Yeah, going back to fate, I mean, I noticed, Ben, you've sort of highlighted that, and we'll point that out in the show notes. But I think that taught me a lot about how to handle those kind of situations where, especially for the players, you know, you don't necessarily have to fight to the death in every battle. You might want to concede, and there's actual mechanics in Fate, which I think probably make combat a lot more interesting, you know, like giving you these options of well, if you concede right now, then you won't necessarily lose everything, lose complete control, whereas you still have some creative control over what happens to your character if you kind of say, well, all right, actually, I don't want to continue. You've hit the wall and you can't go any further.
Yeah, Fate actually rewards you for, like I say, taking that sort of early surrender, recognizing you're about to drop and actually going, well, wouldn't it be more interesting to actually get captured now and then? Which are a lot of systems which, as much as system says, hey, it'd be really cool if the monsters capture you, no player is going to is going to surrender because they've all played fight to the death combats.
Yeah.
They're like, well, if we surrender, we're going to get killed. We don't want to be the dead people. We want them to be the dead people. So combat becomes extremely binary, and you get the dreaded TPK moment where you realise your monsters are better than the players and you're about to kill them. And you're trying to encourage the players to surrender because you don't want the TPK, and your players are like, no, no, no.
I think something interesting that you brought up there is fight should be about something else other than just kill these guys.
Yeah.
And which is something which we forget so often.
There should be different things at stake.
Yeah. Like, I suppose, like, a fairly advanced opportunity, a fairly advanced thing is this, is like, also you have to save a group of people who are there. Also, you have to stop a fire from consuming everything. Also, you have to escape with the jewels in time before the cops show up, that sort of thing. If you make a fight which isn't just, we are here and we're going to meat grind each other until one side is just dead, which doesn't often happen in real life, or indeed in narratives or anything, there should be a reason for the fight. I think the stakes are really important. If you look at games like Dogs in the Vineyard or Apocalypse World, things like that, what their combats have which are different from standard D&D, it's not a strict mechanical representation of what's going on, but what do you want to happen after this fight is over? So, like, the reason why I'm fighting is I want my brother-in-law to not go and kill the town prostitute in Dogs in the Vineyard is kind of the traditional example. And what you do then is the fight is a means to an end. It's not we are fighting because fighting is fun. It's we're fighting because we want to exert our will on the world. And what are we prepared to do to exert our will on the world? And you can certainly do that with Dungeons & Dragons and more trad role-playing games by saying, what do you want out of this fight? What are the stakes? If you win this fight, what happens? If you lose this fight, what happens? And so it's not, if we lose this fight, we die. Because that's, like, I can certainly have that. If you're trapped in a dungeon, this is the last stand, if you lose this fight, you die. Traditionally, if we lose this fight, the orcs take over the inn. If we win this fight, we drive the orcs back from the inn and push them back to their homestead or whatever. And that makes for a much more interesting combat, because it also frames what the orcs are getting out of it, rather than, the orcs are here to kill you, and we'll just thrash about like bags of hit points with axes until they all die. It's more so, actually, these orcs really want this pub, which makes it quite certain, because like the orcs are maybe like, oh, actually, one of them goes over there and bars the door to stop anyone else getting in to help you. One of them throws open the door to let in their reinforcements. One of them says, I'm going to knock down this wall when I get in here. I'm going to put in a load of wonderful rugs and serve all sorts of beautiful orcish beer. Doesn't matter. At that point, like, you realise what the stakes of the fight are, and it's become much more interesting.
Yeah.
I just love the idea. It's orcs now running around with tape measures in the background.
Yeah. We should install a mirror in here, boys, to give the illusion of space.
I was picturing like the orcs version of The Sims or something, you know.
Yeah.
Like, interior decorator at heart. Missed his calling and ended up being an axe swinging thug. No, I forgot what I was going to say. You said it so well.
It was about having a reason to fight, I think, is the thing, like, and to have an outcome other than, and fate is this, as you're saying.
Yeah, well, I think the reason that some of those nonsensical fight-to-death things happen is, or at least from my perspective, I get focused so much on the mechanics, and you're just thinking about, as you say, bags of hit points that are opposing the characters, and you kind of forget that they're thinking, you know, beings, unless they're not, obviously, if they're, you know, sort of like Terminator creatures that just don't stop. But yeah, as you say, that should be rare. That should be like a really unusual circumstance.
And it should be scary as well.
Mm. And you feel more, I think we talked about this in a previous episode, you feel more impacted if your characters know what the stakes are and are invested in what's going on, and you know what both sides, what their motivations are. It's a lot more thrilling, I think. So.
You're using Bonetti's defense against me, huh?
I thought it fitting, considering the rocky terrain.
Naturally. You must expect me to attack with Capaferro.
Naturally. But I find that Tybalt cancels out Capaferro. Don't you?
Tell us about dialogue during combat, John.
So someone wrote an article, maybe it was on that excellent blog, lookrobot.co.uk, but I can't remember where I actually read it. Was it you, Grant? Did you? That's Grant's blog, by the way. Someone, I'll have to find it and put it in the show notes, but there's an excellent sort of treatise on having, breaking up combat and not just having just loads of dice rolls and swings and actually having real sort of interaction, as you might in a comic book, you know, where, you know, that you've got the hero and he's on his you know, at the end of his tether, and he's sort of clinging on for dear life in there, or like in Star Wars, where they're having a meaningful, somewhat conversation in amongst all the stuff that's going on, and it can make things more interesting. You know, obviously you're not going to have a long soliloquy during combat, but you're going to have some kind of more than just grunts and I'm going to get you and let's shoot him or duck behind cover. You might have something like that you'd see cinematically in a film, people that sort of mentally facing off against one another.
It raises an interesting point for me, like having dialogue or just talking in combat. Penny Arcade, the popular webcomic, less popular these days on account of the misogyny, but we'll gloss over that. They have an ongoing D&D game called Acquisitions Incorporated, where they play basically a chaotic selfish party, as is tradition for D&D. And I was listening to this years ago. I listened to one of the ones which they released when 4th Ed first came out, 4th Ed D&D. And they had this really good dungeon master. I was trying to work out why I really liked listening to him speak. And he had these goblins come out. It's just a basic first level fight against some goblins. You're going to keep on the borderlands, which is a classic D&D adventure. Mm. And one of these goblins comes out. They have they have a bit of chat in between each other, but it's not boring. It doesn't go on. He isn't just doing NPCs talking to each other. And then a fight kicks off, and the guys are fighting. And then it's the goblin's turn. And then every other time I'd seen something happen, every other time I'd seen a goblin attack someone, it'd just be okay. The goblin rolls to hit you, and he stabs you, and you're damaged. He said, "The goblin says I'm gonna mash your bones into flour for my bread or something." And then instantly it was like, "Oh, that goblin likes eating bone bread." Mm. And it just gave him a tiny little bit of character. At that point, it was like, okay, cool. I realized this is a thing. This is a person who matters. You know, this is a character. And so what I learned after that and what I did, aside from dialogue, is to have a single descriptor for everything I put in. So every sort of monster, you never just have generic orc. You never just have orc or whatever. You have orc, and you might just write after it dreadlocks. Or orc bones, orc glowing red eyes, orc filed teeth, orc tattoos, all these things. And it's like, so rather than having, yeah, there's one orc here and the second orc that you're fighting, rather than defining them by, here is the orc which you're fighting and here's the orc which your mate is fighting and they are just bags of hit points. Here's an orc and his face is covered in piercings and he keeps cackling. And here's an orc and he thinks he's a bard, so he's got a drum and he keeps smacking away on it rhythmically throughout the fight. That just instantly sort of sets the characters in the minds of the players and lets them explore what's going on. And dialogue can certainly do that. To have just a snarled threat from someone instantly elevates them above your standard NPC in a computer game.
That's amazing. I mean, that's really putting a lot of detail and giving the impression that these aren't just sort of generic entities that you're coming up against, but they actually sort of have, there's an internal logic in the world that exists that, you know, these creatures are obeying, you know. It sounds a bit like 13th Age, where you've got the sort of one unique thing.
It's a game, 13th Age. I'm a huge fan of it. I'm currently in two games of it.
I'm determined to start a campaign soon. I'm going to wait for their Glorantian 13th Age kind of Kickstarter, because I love RuneQuest, but I'm getting a bit tired of the mechanics of it, so I'd love to try and take all that into 13th Age and give it a go.
Thank you for everything.
Okay.
Bye-bye, boys.
Have fun storming the castle.
One more thing on, the sort of describing monsters. I'm playing at the moment old-school castles and crusades, and I'm actually playing that online using Fantasy Grounds, which is a tabletop emulator for computers, so from very, very far away. And we're playing through some really old school Castle Crusades adventures, and there's the Wandering Monster Table. And the Wandering Monster Table is everything against what we've just described. It is a bunch of random things that appear with no purpose. The fight has no reason other than punishing you for spending a long time wandering around in the wilderness.
Yeah.
And you fight a bunch of generic goblins, and they've got no names. In fact, in the software, of course, you just drag and drop the encounter, and they appear on the combat tracker as Goblin 1, Goblin 2, Goblin 3. So they're about as generic as they can get. But then the party gets to town, and in the town is the group of NPCs they probably end up going to fight and kill. But they've all got names, and they're all really kind of fleshed. There's an interesting band of people, and I'm trying to describe this, who these people are, do a bit of a dialogue to get the party interested, but they've just been spoon-fed kill, kill, kill for the last 20 encounters. So why do they care these people have got names all of a sudden?
Yeah.
As you say, they're just five more bags of hit points standing in the way of them and some loot. So now I'm trying to break them out of the habit, but it's too late. I've reinforced it with all these fairly meaningless encounters. But one idea that's actually come out of this now is, because I write some of the software for Fantasy Grounds, would be, I might write a little add-on, which instead of doing Goblin 1, Goblin 2, I'm going to have my list of traits. So there's Goblin tattoos, Goblin randomly banging drums.
Might as well.
I think it'd be awesome.
It makes it.
Welcome to Whose Line Is It Anyway? The improvisation show where rehearsed is a dirty word and dirty words are over-rehearsed.
One other thing I want to say as well is, like, part of making combat more interesting is a really basic improv thing. So I did a couple of improv classes a while ago. I can recommend anyone who roleplays go and do improv classes if you've got the money and the time and the opportunity. They're invaluable, they are fun, they let you, and they give you some good lessons for life in general. One of the crucial things about improv is a concept known as called building a platform. So say, for example, in an improv scene, if we set a scene in an art gallery, then if the scene then had two people walking into the art gallery, walking dogs, and they had an argument about their dogs, the audience would be dissatisfied because that's not about an art gallery. And we are used to narratives where something important is established, and then the reason for that being important is delivered on later. And D&D is obviously improvised. A huge amount of it is improvised. We can predict things, but because we have characters which we can't control directly, because those players are insisting on controlling them, we have to use a lot of improv techniques. And so, if you populate the area with stuff, so like rather than having you're in a 10x10, sorry, you're in a 40x40 room, you're in a ballroom. It is a crumbling ballroom, a relic of ages past, and there are tattered silk drapes on the walls, and you can hear distant creepy music playing from some sort of magical organ which is suspended in midair, at which point people can then say, you know what, I'm going to tie someone up in those drapes, I'm going to try and bring that organ down on someone, I'm going to grab someone and start dancing with them. That gives you the platform to then have satisfying interactions come back round. And the example I gave was a bit daft because it was a ballroom. But if you think of things like traditional fighting arenas, like trenches, for example, if you're having a fantasy war and you describe the rolling smoke across the trenches, and you describe how wet the mud is, and the stench of death, and how there's bodies everywhere. Those are all things which players, if you let them, can wrap back in, and you can wrap back in, and then suddenly it's like, oh, that's why the bodies are there. Because because I'm going to drop my axe and frantically grab an amputated leg and smack a goblin around the head with it. It gives them reasons to be there. It makes them important, and that's hugely satisfying to see as a player or a GM.
And that's fate all over. The great thing of fate is you are encouraged to slap down two aspects and be amazed what your players come up with, knowing for the simple spending of a fate chip, they can pick an aspect, pick something cool, and they're going to get +2 for their cool idea.
Yeah, fate has a really lovely way of describing fate aspects. I want to reproduce it here. It was on the blog. Fred Hicks wrote it. So fate works off a system called aspects. It's the most important thing about it is you say, this is an aspect of my character, and then you can tag that aspect by spending fate points to make your action more mechanically viable. So it gives you a bonus, or it gives you a reroll. And the system, however, also uses things like standard environmental things. So in D&D, if a room's dark, then you can't see properly in it. Enemies have concealment. You might trip over something. And there was a question saying, so do I have to have the aspect on the room, this room is dark, for the darkness to have any sort of effect? And the guy who designed the game was like, no, actually, the game still has darkness still has an effect. People still can't see each other clearly, it's hard to find things, it's easier to hide. But if you tag it as an aspect, that's Batman darkness. At which point, you walk in there, and it's really spooky, creepy darkness, and then there's this giant man dressed as a bat who will come out and break your arm and throw you off a cliff and attach you to a grappling hook. Because it becomes an integral part of the scene. And all too often, we end up in fights which are just sat in these really boring rooms, and it's clinical, because like, I think we're used to in a way to having a pre-written adventures where people are GMs and players are really worried about messing with stuff because you might mess up the designer's intention. Or we play computer games. Computer games are intentionally very dry because you can't push too far to interact with what's going on. And like, and if a computer game has destructible environments, that's seen as a really exciting thing still, despite the fact it's 2015. Whereas in a role-playing game, we can have anything we want. We have unlimited budgets. We have limited special effects budgets. We have unlimited depth of interaction with the world. And so we should be encouraging players to poke the world and try and do stuff and saying, yes, that works, it's really exciting, this happens. Rather than, no, that doesn't work, no, you can't push that table over, no, it does nothing, you're an idiot for not just rolling a basic attack. And in fact,
yeah,
I'm going to stop talking soon because I've been waffling a lot, but if you take nothing else away from this podcast, this is the most important thing I have to say. Never, ever, ever make your players roll anything other than their basic attack damage if they describe an exciting attack.
Yes, because, I like that rule.
Because it's really cool to have like to have a fighter smack some guy's head into a table, but yeah, if that does D3 damage rather than D8 for his longsword, he'll just use his longsword.
At that point, they're trying to contribute. They're trying to engage with the story, and when you shut them down, which rules often don't tell you to do that. Rules often just sort of say, well, here's a set of tables to look at, and you just go away and have fun. Yeah. But yeah, some of the best DMs back in the day would just say, no, you know, sod the rules. That was really cool. That's what's happening. Or they may still make you roll, but then whatever you've said kind of feeds into what's happening. So you kind of have to like gauge with your group, but I think taking Grant's suggestion is not a bad way to improve combat and improve a game. Is if they're giving you material to use it. Definitely don't shut them down or say, well, no, that's not going to happen.
Or say it does D3 damage rather than D8, because at which point, like, it's not mechanically viable, and mechanical viability is dull.
Yeah, statistics generally aren't fun, and unfortunately they have a big place in a lot of role-playing games, because that's how it started, right? It was just sort of...
And it also gives you a world which you can understand and master, which is a huge part of the fun of role-playing games. And if you look at say like the forums on Pathfinder, for example, there are huge amounts of rule questions like, by the way, I play a paladin, and the paladin's focused around restraining enemies. If, unfortunately, once I tie up an enemy, that means I have to draw my rope again, and it takes another standard action. Is there any way I could have my rope ready as a quick action? And it's like, what? that was important enough for you to post on the internet about? Because the system is manageable and, importantly, masterable. So if you're good at shanking guys in Pathfinder, you're really provably good at shanking guys, rather than, well, I figured it'd be interesting to shank guys, so I'm as good at shanking guys as this guy is at jumping over buildings, for example. You are mechanically viable in this one way, and luckily shanking guys is a fundamental part of Pathfinder.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I play obviously a lot of... Oh, my God, we're talking about board games briefly. I say play a lot of board games, a lot of thematic ones, but also I was playing pretty heavy Euro games last night, which is unlike me, but I was in a strange place. And, yeah, it's trying to... At some point, I was trying to get the extra point I needed. I was playing around more things, and I realised the game's pretty well balanced. There's no, this item's more powerful than that item. I was trying to get something I just wasn't going to get because I didn't have the right combination of stuff. And that actually kind of made me happy because I realised I didn't have any broken items. I didn't have, well, this item's always better than that item, so I should always be using this. I mean, it actually, yeah, translates back to role-playing games as well. Like, if you're playing a very mechanically heavy game, you are going to check if the system's broken. You're going to kick the tire. You'll say, well, actually doing kind of attacks always better than this kind of attack. So why would I want to do this kind of attack? Because mechanically, I'm trying to win the game. So people apply the same focus to Euros as they do to the heavy mechanics games. There's a lot of pressure on GM if he thinks he is a mechanic broken game to try and fix it up and try to do the fun stuff whilst not completely changing all the mechanics of this shared system people have invested in.
Euros I can certainly dig because it's a board game. You know, it's designed to be a challenge or a duel between all the different players. And I think breaking out of that and showing people story games and showing people games which like take some small measure of control, maybe not away from their character, but let them describe the world. I think like a crucial part of story games, a lot of story games, is being able to say an NPC walks in the door and he's like this. And for the GM to go, yeah, that's fine, rather than, I haven't plotted this NPC out in my relationship map, what the hell am I going to do? To have that sort of freedom, like, to kind of relax the boundaries between, the only thing you control is the inviolable space between your character's ears. Just kind of just fuzzy that out. So you can control the things around your character, and you can put forward suggestions as to why you failed that lockpicking role. Because a guard came and I had to shoulder the door in, and now it's all broken and he's poking around. If your player suggests that, God, that's wonderful. Yeah?
No, absolutely, yeah.
You're hit. You're bleeding, man.
I ain't got time to bleed.
You got time to duck. I mean, that sort of brings up an interesting point, Grant. If you're having interesting things in combat that don't necessarily directly have to do with hitting and killing other people, that could be interesting too. You sort of got this time-based thing where things are happening really quickly because it's combat, but meanwhile there's a guy over in the corner who's trying to open the door or seal it against the aliens trying to get in, or reprogram the what's it thing to save the world or whatever. Having other interesting stuff happening while other people are fighting could be cool.
And you can get this in D&D. It's normally one of the players is bleeding out. The moment a player is bleeding out in D&D, combat becomes a lot more fun, a lot more tense. Like, how many more rounds has he got? And then you play with the GM who doesn't allow you to tell people how many negative hit points you've got. We're not sure. He took 7 damage. How many more rounds do you think he might have till he dies? Suddenly D&D combat became a lot more exciting. It's just a
shame. So
you death to create that.
Upon starting a D&D combat, immediately reduce one random player to negative 10 hit points.
Get the fun going straight away. But, I mean, there was a lovely, it's very railroady module made for Savage Worlds, but it was Daring Tales of Adventure, which I think I've talked about before. It's a kind of pulpy set, two-fisted against the Nazis kind of thing. But brilliantly, they've made sure every combat has a cinematic. It's a film. Basically, every scene is a scene out of a film, and every combat's got the thing, like Dr. X is about to unleash the nerve toxin upon New York, or Fate as well. Something's on fire. Always have something on fire. Keeps things moving along. And every combat's kind of exciting and has a limitation based on a number of rounds, or like there'll be a chase scene, and after a certain amount of rounds, it happens just to end it and move the game along. It was very mechanically prescribed, but it really opened my eyes to all these combats are fun. Everyone was talking about them again. Oh, that was really cool when that happened. Whereas, sometimes D&D combats are getting in the way of getting anywhere.
Which we may be getting away from here
is the reason why we have these. Okay, so example in the 13th Age combat I ran on Thursday night, we happened to the final roll of the game was a 20 to kill a dragon. And it was really cool, and it was really exciting, and it also happened to cue in when we put on the Immigrant Song by Led Zeppelin, because we were all 17-year-old virgins. And it had the bum da ba da bum ba dum ba ba dum bum, and it kicked in the ah, and you rolled the dice and it hit a 20 and you colour sprayed a dragon to death, and it was rad. And that happened, that was exciting because D&D, it was 13th Age, but it runs off D&D, is a relatively uncaring system in that it has, if it's fate, then the reason why we succeeded was because the GM wanted us to succeed, because we're competent people, because we're supposed to succeed, because that's the story. Whereas in D&D, there's still this sort of overshadowing thing which feels a bit like Dark Souls or Metroid, where there is a world which you're exploring, and so when something interesting happens, that's because you're awesome, rather than because we all agreed that we're awesome. And there's this weird sort of there's a weird sense of achievement that you've beaten the world, that you've beaten this fairly dry mechanical world. And of course, it's exactly the same narratively as when you in Wushu or when you in Fate just describe doing something rad because you know the dragon's on its last legs, or because you have the narrative juice to say I'm going to end this fight right now and slide your tokens across the table or whatever. But there's something to be said for that, and I think that's why so many people go back to D&D, why so many people go back to traditional role-playing games, because it has that satisfying idea of beating something.
Mm. Getting better, also.
Yes.
I mean, there's a definite progression, right? That, I mean, the game is kind of centered around this leveling and gaining experience and gaining more abilities, and then seeing that, I can see why, especially back in the early days, I don't know how it works now exactly, but there is a sense of achievement of like, oh boy, I started from nothing and I could barely hold it together against a couple of goblins, and now can take on a dragon single-handedly or something. So I can see that being an appeal, and there's nothing sort of wrong with that enjoyment necessarily. And I kind of want to go back. We were talking about how players, you know, you should take suggestions from players. We're not necessarily saying that you should just let everyone win and make cool things happen for your players all the time. I mean, sometimes cool things for the right kind of players are bad things, like in Fate, where you can get maimed. You know, if you can't take that extra consequence, then it's going to be something that stays with you for a while, and so you might get your arm mangled or something, and that's something that kind of becomes part of your character for a while, and that can be interesting as well.
I think fundamentally, like, the important thing is when players make an action in a role-playing game, they want the world to change. Yeah. And so if a fight happens and some goblins are dead and all we got was some XP, that's not a hugely exciting thing. No, but right. It's a fight, and we lost the inn, and now my hand doesn't work as well as it used to. That's a story.
Yeah.
It feels like the world has changed and the character has changed, and change is what makes good stories.
And I would say it may not necessarily be everything that your players expect. It might be something that seems bad at first and actually turns out to be in their favor, or it could be a slightly different outcome, but something interesting and remarkable happens rather than, okay, you defeated them and got their gold and now we move on to the next faceless combat. But I think I wanted to sort of talk about how these things should be challenging. Players, a lot of people do want to feel like they've come up against a challenge and succeeded, either through via cleverness or by cunning or by one reason or another.
This raises an important dichotomy for me in role-playing games, which I kind of want to talk about, in that philosophically, I believe that the way to run a good game is, no matter what the players do, it's an adventure. So whatever they choose, they will find an appropriate resistance put against them. Mm. So if they find some clever way around it, then that way is itself difficult. There's like, it might be, oh, turns out this guy's weak against carrots. Oh, unfortunately, he knows he's weak against carrots, so he's bought out all the carrot stocks and he's locked them up in a bank vault. So it's bank. The core is, and because people come to role-playing games with this really masochistic air, they're really expecting to have an acceptable, exciting challenge made for their characters. They want the characters to get hurt, they want them to get beaten up, put through the ringer, humiliated, not thwarted, but always on that edge of being thwarted and being hurt and being killed, certainly. And so for me to have the we've outsmarted the villain, we as players have come up with a solution smart enough to circumnavigate this challenge, that doesn't really sit right with me. And I suppose, if it's a really good solution, then cool, okay, what's the next challenge? That works for you, but then what's the most interesting thing that's happened to you? It's like starting a book. You don't start a book on the most boring day of a character's life, you start on the most exciting day of a character's life, is the traditional aphorism. And so keeping, like, pushing characters forward into exciting days, I think, is the thing. So if you realize that the dragon's cave has support struts and you can destroy it and kill the dragon without bringing yourself into any sort of damage, okay, what's the challenge out of that? Like, what sort of ramifications did that have? Did the dragon have cults and now they're coming to kill you? Was the dragon a fundamental part of keeping the little princess population down and now they're overbreeding? That sort of thing. Actually, that's quite a good idea for a game. So that sort of thing. And I think it depends on what sort of game you're running. If you look at something like Shadowrun, it is precisely the game of what John said, which is, here is a plan. If you just go into this straightforward, you will die. Come up with a clever enough idea that I don't kill you. And it just gets right on my wig. I have no time for the system. It's just a dungeon crawl with all the fun taken out.
Step away from the Shadowrun. Step away from...
Yeah, sorry. I had some guy come on. So, for the uninitiated listeners, I wrote a blog post about Shadowrun nearly 2 years ago when I got a copy of 5th Ed for my birthday, and just how much I hated Shadowrun. And how thankful I was the guy who got it for me for my birthday, because he gave me something to hate. And I'm still getting angry comments on it to this day, saying, how dare you not play the system because you just don't like the rule book? That's illogical! And so I actually wrote a system for that guy, which there's a 1 in 6 chance you have to kick a piece of furniture hard, which he now has to play, otherwise he can't pass judgment on it. So that's fun. I assume it's a he.
But anyway, the core message of I think what I'm getting at, and to tie it back into the tying back in the subject of the podcast, whatever players do, something exciting should happen.
Mm. And that's one of the core tenets of Fate, isn't it? You know, whatever choices they make, they should be interesting. There should never be a boring answer. And I think that's a great piece of advice. We've kind of touched on death before in the game, and not every, the stakes shouldn't always be about saving the universe in every combat or every plot that you run in a game. And for my part, like going back to the D&D mentality, the basic mentality of D&D, I've had a player tell me that actually a lot of GMs just seem to positively delight in being sort of this tyrannical overlord who's just thrilled when a player gets killed. Versus the other side of the coin, which is someone who, I always felt like we were creating a story together, so it's this collaborative thing. So I'm rooting for the heroes just as much as the bad guys. But you can go wrong with that. They're not feeling challenged, or if there's not enough at stake, then it can kind of feel flat and just anticlimactic. Years ago, I knew a GM. I never actually got to play in a game with him, but he was kind of legendary, and he had a risk-reward balance that I think he just was able to walk perfectly. And the players really loved his games because they knew that the more that they risked, the rewards would be greater. But then there were consequences, and everyone felt the consequences. It wasn't like sort of like, okay, well, you failed, but, you know, everything's okay, and I guess you don't get the chalice, but you managed to get to the end of the adventure, and, you know... If they failed, they failed hard, and and so it made that succeeding all that more sweet.
And like risk as well it's all too easy to have you're fighting for the sake of the world. And you know what I care far more about than the whole world? My mum. If the whole world is destroyed, well, my mum's destroyed as well. And like, you know, we're not especially close, my mum and I. We love each other, but we don't talk. Yeah. We don't talk much. But if I'm a fighting type and someone's like, you know what, we've got your mum. Holy shell fight at that point. Rather than, you know what, we're going to destroy the world. Well, I can't really imagine what that would be like. Like, you're in the world. All our eggs are in the same basket here. I think like tailoring the risk and tailoring the... I'm a huge fan of having characters be related to each other, because that just gives you an instant reason to be interested.
Yep.
And having the risk is something which is, rather than an orphanage is burning down, your old school is burning down, the orphanage in which you were raised is burning down, is much more evocative to a character. And because D&D is effectively about helping each other out through difficult times, one invested character will generally get the rest, most if not all the rest of the party, just rushing along and giving everything they can to that fight, rather than just rolling d20s and exchanging the numbers.
Absolutely. So there was one thing that we touched on. Sorry, this kind of feeds into things we've talked about with Fate and 13th Age. I think in a past episode, we've talked about how you want to involve your characters and to make games as a whole more interesting, not just the combats, but to make their situations, that every decision that they're making interesting, it has to have some kind of personal connection to them, or at least to one character there. So yeah, that's a great bit of advice. But the other thing that you mentioned was music, and having music tie in to what's going on is brilliant, but not everyone can be their own sort of DJ unless you can hire someone to be like a co-GM DJ or something. I mean, that's an idea.
You can get a player to do it. It's a one
of them, because you all know what's going on. You're just like, oh, well, this is going to be an exciting combat. Let's keep the exciting music going. But when it all sort of dovetails together, that's just brilliant. You've got the right.
You do need a system. You need a system that's going to allow you to match that. Classic, you know, we got into pistol shootouts, and we had like Pistolero by, I can't remember who it is, Juno Reactor or something, going like real kind of pumping, gunshots, yay! But the system's actually quite slow and clunky. It took about two. You played for the whole track before everyone had a turn.
We've had. I built a playlist for a Dark Heresy game, and we had like the final battle was like this tremendous epic thing where they took down a Chaos Titan. They drop podded into the top of the onto the top of the Chaos Titan and ripped out the warp drive, which was powering the center. It was really super cool. And so, like, they were just saying, "What sort of guns are we taking here? Well, I think I'll need this." And they were all planning their sort of thing. They were planning out their routes into the Titan. And then suddenly the music just started going dun 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 bum bum, and it was stupid. This is a really important clip of ammunition, I guess, and because we're trained to have exciting music associated with exciting things. And so since then, I've steadfastly DJed everything. So I have my laptop open in front of me, and I will always be in control of the music, and I'll always turn it down if it gets daft. Crucially, like, ambient stuff is better. So, like, rather than having exciting upbeat music, which is really tricky, like, you can put it on once and then go back into something ambient, but, like, electronica is really good because it just exists as noise to, like, fill in the gaps between silences.
Yeah.
And kind of has a low, steady rhythm to keep things going. But I think the best combat we've ever had was, it was in Wushu. It was in one of the games I ran when I started doing it. And it was a chase scene in London with a bunch of effectively wizards stealing cars and teleporting between cars to get out of the city. And we decided that we wanted 100 Mile High City by Ocean Colour scene to be the theme tune. And then that was over, and we realized the scene was going to take about 15 minutes. So we just kept putting it back on repeat. And it really worked. I can recommend doing that. If it's a song that everyone likes, just repeat the same song for 20 minutes. And people generally won't get too upset.
Yeah, because it becomes part of the background. You're not really sitting there thinking about it unless it has lyrics or something that's going to be, you know, or at a high volume level that's going to be in your face. But so here's an interesting experiment. I don't know, not something I've ever tried, but have you ever not told your players, but actually made the stuff that's happening in the game match the music? Say you've put together a playlist and then you're sort of letting the music play. You're still in control of it somewhat, but you're not having to, like, sit there and really, oh, just hold on one second, let me just cue up this, you know, you're actually just letting this playlist go.
Yeah.
Maybe stopping it at certain intervals, but then describing the action according to how the music's swelling, and that would be an interesting experiment to see if players notice it first of all, or if they think, oh, well, that was brilliantly timed. Everything just sort of went along with the music. Oh wait,
I've done that, but that's interesting. It's an interesting thought. It would certainly suit things which had a more relaxed flow in and out of combat, something like World of Darkness, for example. Where combats are over relatively quickly, depending on what you're fighting, you know, what sort of supernaturals you're running with. But something like D&D, there's very much, this is fight time, this is non-fight time. But if you look at something like Dogs in the Vineyard, that would actually be really interesting to have a game where there are no distinct phases of action, to have not necessarily the music slows down and everything soft, rather than saying, oh, you know what, the guy gives up and surrenders. He's like, I can't believe you do this to me, your brother. And just throw things in. And maybe let the players know that you're improvising around it, you know, and let the players do it as well.
Mm.
That sounds like a really interesting thing. And, like, building that playlist would be fascinating, especially keeping it thematic without having something really jarring dropping in.
Yeah, these days there's loads of great people that produce music specifically for games. I think most of it's probably the fantasy variety, but with all the soundtracks for films out there, I mean, there's a whole wealth of stuff to draw from. So,
what's your favourite soundtrack for playing to, John?
Oh, I think it really depends on the game, because obviously some films, you can't. It's hard to play a Star Wars game without some kind of John Williams score going in the background, but I don't know. If I have a favorite, there's certain composers that I've noticed that work really well. I can't think of his name. It's kind of hard to pronounce. I think it's Djawadi. He did some stuff for, like, the Unborn, I think. It was a horror film about twins. It was quite probably forgettable, but I stumbled onto the soundtrack for a few of his work, and I found it really good for background.
Ramin Djawadi is the name.
There you go. I still can't pronounce it, but
the Assassin's Creed.
Which
I think are very good, like, for having generic fantasy.
Some video game soundtracks are actually great for that also, because they're designed to be sort of looping in the background, so for you to, like, hear every once in a while, but not really pay too much attention to. They're just giving you a little bit of an atmosphere and theme, some motifs, as they say.
And Assassin's Creed,
Assassin's Creed soundtracks are traditionally set in exciting, like foreign exotic cities, unless you play the third Assassin's Creed game, which you shouldn't do. And so they have like they have this kind of lilting air. Oh, something exciting is about to happen around the very next corner. I really like it. Again, it's fun. It gives the opportunity to drop something unexpected in.
Ben, you were going to say something?
No, I was going to say, well, I actually remember one of our early games together, John, where we did some Don't Rest Your Head stuff, and I think you'd had a few key scenes in mind of a few key songs for soundtracks, which I've never thought about mining the glorious soundtrack and getting stuff off that. I remember some really memorable scenes because you have a song and it would very much put that scene into some sort of extra reality, I don't think it would have had otherwise. And yeah, that's why I've definitely been trying to work in more soundtrack stuff, but I think I've been a bit lazy. I picked up, like you say, a lot of fantasy music's been written out there. So there's a Midnight Syndicate written up, banks and banks of albums of generic fantasy stuff or generic Cthulhu-like stuff, which is just very nice for putting in the background and picking a couple of tracks out of.
Yeah, I don't know about you guys, but that's kind of my process when I'm thinking about running a game or when I'm sort of imagining scenes in my head. I'll often be listening to different pieces of orchestral or soundtracks, and then that will sometimes give me inspiration for stuff, and then I'll want to use it actually in the game because that's evocative for me of what I imagined. So that's how that one.
And then there's the other kind of audio versus you can give a sort of soundscape stuff. I think is the name of the app. Or there's tabletopaudio.com, which is actual trying to get real life the noises that are actually happening around you rather than using the music, which I've had mixed success with. I think the Sirenscape software is looking pretty good now, but I haven't played with it very much.
There's a company called
Real Swords. Yes, so that's another one. Yeah.
Playmograms, they make 10-minute long tracks. There's a chap who did soundtracks for films and background music for films and cartoons and TV shows. And they make tracks like Inside a Dead God and On an Abandoned Space Station and On Board Deck During a Storm. And they're either just sound effects, or they have, you know, weird ambient noises depending on what's going on, or they have maybe a tune playing which loops. And they're distinctly designed to be 10 minutes of looping audio, which you stick on and then forget about. They're about $1.50 each, and they're the best music I've played during a game. They're really evocative, really weird, really creepy, or really, really cool. And you can generally afford $150 for a thing if that's going to be like your standout scene for the game. So I can really recommend taking a look at them and having a play with them. But takes out the DJing element.
Yeah, I think Tabletop Audio is sort of the same deal. They're free. They're sort of donateware that if you kind of get into it, they've got their patron to sponsor them and follow them. But yeah, Patreon.
I think Patron is a kind of a cure, I'm not entirely sure.
So, moving on to a question for you guys, what do you think about making like mass combats interesting? And I don't necessarily mean just where you've got one group of players against hordes of meaningless enemies, because I think we all know how to kind of pare down that that slog. But like if you're sort of at a level of a campaign where you've got, you're sort of actually moving armies around and you're at a scale where it's countries instead of just one group of players. Do you think there's any useful ways of making that interesting?
I mean, yeah, certainly. The system Rain, which is expressly designed that you play someone who has access to armies and access to military and power, which then lets you mechanically throw your armies against each other and have that done out in a similar method to your just turning up and hitting each other with swords. But the way I'd recommend doing it for normal games is that the fight happens in the background and the player's actions affect the fight importantly. So say like there's a war going on and the camera pans down and there's legions of dead and dying people and there's massive wars going on, and then the heroes are surrounded as the camera spins around them. The fight heroes are surrounded by 10 enemy soldiers, and they decide like this is where they're going to make their stand, or the heroes are leading the charge to recapture this important fort, or the heroes leading the defense of the Maginot Line, whatever. By focusing on that one objective, you focus more back to the standard D&D skirmish level, but you cut everything else out. I think that like the way I've described mass combat in the past is to write down each unit or like Like, so for example, last time I did it, it was 13th Age, our Dwarven fighter was leading a group of river pirates, which he'd recruited in, it was a coastal battle against some gnoll pirates, which he was doing. And so I wrote down river pirate on an index card and gave it to him. And then whenever he wants, he can re-roll a dice and flip, re-roll a d20 and flip over that index card and describe the fact that he's leading a unit of guys helping him out.
Wow, cool.
And that gives you a little benefit for doing it, and it encourages him to describe it and think, oh, actually, you know what, this role is important enough, I'm going to have one of my mates turn up and help me. But just run it as a normal fight and have the stuff and as description seems to work well enough for me.
Fair enough. I think there are some systems that have some support for kind of actually running the mass battle if you care about the outcome of the mass battle. Otherwise, yeah, I think mass battle I've often treated more like the fate aspect. It's something happening in the background, and feel free to invoke it, feel free to bring it up and increase or decrease challenges based on the fact you are in the middle of a big fight. But normally what I think you want the players to be doing in a big fight is standard adventuring, doing overcoming some challenges. Maybe there's something they need to do to swing the tide of the fight.
And then that keeps from blowing up the wall.
Absolutely. And you get this obviously in sort of mass battles in movies and sort of Lord of the Rings and stuff. Yes, there is this big battle, but oh look, here are the heroes. They go off to do something really, really important now, like secure the gate, stop the sapper, do the very, very useful thing that's going to massively change the outcome of the battle, but may not actually involve them in combat. May involve them overcoming other challenges, something inventive, etc.
I don't know what Rain's like, but imagine, how about a slightly different situation though, where, because I take your point, I think that's probably the best way to handle mass combat is to not really do it at all, you know, it's a background color thing, yeah.
Have the players' actions as a microcosm of the mass combat, so if they lose, the side loses.
And I'm thinking from a very high level view, but imagine if you had the scope of a campaign where one player was actually a ruler and the other PCs were generals or something, and so they're sort of each doing their own thing, interacting with one another, but then I don't think that's very realistic, is it? Because in a real, at least a medieval style combat, you're not going to be talking to one another, and so they're essentially isolated, and that's not very exciting, is it? Well, but I could see making decisions in a big strategy. They're having to make split second decisions, like in The Walking Dead. You know, like, oh, the bridge is collapsed. Do we go left or right?
Yeah,
Sergeant.
I think mechanically D&D and traditional role playing games don't support that as a grade, because it's skirmish level combat, and what it's more about, it's kind of sergeant level combat or trooper level. And once you hit general, then actually it's our system breakdown, and so it seems less interesting because it's too abstracted from what we're normally doing.
Is there a way to make it interesting?
I think you just have to write the system.
Okay.
Or potentially look at doing something like taking the standard model for here is an orc and saying instead, right, this represents 100 orcs.
Yeah.
And this represents 100 fighters like you. Like, so at which point you're leading this, and so you narratively describe 100 orcs smacking into each other and killing each other, but you're just using the standard mechanics to do it. That would still work, but like in terms of difficult decisions, that's not something which current D&D or 13th Age or, well, Pathfinder does support it, but actually it's more like, I think you'd have to have a system which clearly laid out, whatever you do, there will be a problem with this.
Yeah, the original AD&D had battle system, which was then they actually scaled the rules up so you could play full-on battles with the D&D monsters and rules for how your players kind of get involved, but it turns out the answer is not very much. Unless you are a 20th level wizard throwing out fireballs, which actually is not that much different to a bunch of arrows. You wipe out 30 units, but in a mass scale, your fireball doesn't count as much as it used to. It was quite effective and quite powerful.
I think I like the abstraction of, like, if you described it in fate terms, first of all, you'd have to make it interesting. So these aren't just groups of different foot soldiers who are just generic, but like each player is in command of a cohort, which has a character of its own. Like in fate terms, is essentially a character, and it has so many levels of hit points or consequences or whatever, however fate uses, tracks health, and it sort of exists as an entity like a character, so it's got a specialization, it's good at something, And a lot of video games do this, where you've got this sort of rock, paper, scissors situation, and it's about balancing all that stuff together. That could be interesting, but I don't know that it's a circumstance that happens a lot, but for some reason in the course of the discussion, it sounds like it'd be a fun challenge, you know, making that interesting, where, and then maybe zooming in every once in a while to, okay, now we have this brief lull in the larger combat, and you're going back down to the scale of the characters, and they're trying to do stuff to affect the outcome. And then it goes back to, okay, now we've overcome that, now we have to send our forces in again, and how are we going to do that? I think that could be intriguing.
Or you can trick your role-playing friends into board gaming by picking up, I think, the new D&D Attack World Super War has come out, which is the Fantasy Flight Games have taken their X-Wing system, it was obviously Star Wars, and sold them lots of money, and they've now put a D&D version out, which I think is the new D&D mass battle system effect. And yeah, it's going to cost you hundreds of dollars to buy it, and it looks really, really pretty. And I want it.
Victory was near, but the power of the ring could not be undone.
So, what do you guys think? Have we covered everything that we can think of? Is there anything?
I'm pretty exhausted. I've run out of tips to give, certainly.
I was going to say maybe we should recap, do our best to summarize what we've kind of covered.
Well, we've been writing it down, so we can possibly use that.
Well, I think one of the first things you mentioned was don't waste people's time. Time is limited, and combat should, to be fun, it should be quick. I mean, combat in real life is probably very, very fast, so I don't know if that's the kind of situation where... I've been in games where combat was... There was an urgency, and the GM made you feel it. It's like, okay, what are you going to do? You know, and then if you couldn't decide, boom, you you know, if you were sat there going, you know, I'm not... What can I do? Then the GM would just kind of move on to the next person. It wouldn't skip you necessarily, but it was to reinforce the fact that time's going by quickly, and the stuff that's happening is fast and furious.
I think that depends on the genre of role-playing you're doing as well, because, yeah, in real life, combat is fast, but also it's very rare, the amount of combat that most people will have. And especially in lethal combat. And also, like, in my life, I've been in a fight and I didn't take my hands out of my pocket. I don't really know what fighting is like, especially like when it's life and death. And I think what we should be more interested in terms of role-playing combat is recreating a genre or giving the players a feeling. So if you want the players to feel panicked because it's a horror game, then there's ways in which you can do it. If you want players to feel competent because it's 4th ed D&D, then there's ways in which you can do that. And you can give them... leniences or non-leniences. But if it's 4th ed D&D, like, you can assume people are pretty good at fighting. And so rushing them through is kind of a bit like saying, if they're playing a fencing master and you say, okay, what fencing move are you going to do now? Oh, I don't know any fencing moves. Well, you miss! Next character! And it's that sort of thing. It's like, that's kind of punishing them for character knowledge versus in-character stuff.
Absolutely.
But there's certainly a benefit to having combat go super, super fast, but I think it depends on genre.
I think the message is, like, don't waste people's time. You know, just precisely. You shouldn't be focusing too much on the mechanics. And from that point, if your players are giving you interesting stuff, and as I think your rule, if I can mangle it by repeating it, is, you know, if they describe something that's really cool, then the only role they shouldn't have to make is the damage role. So, and I think that's a great piece of advice. Check out Wushu. I mean, it's definitely, I think it does take a certain kind of experienced player to get what's going on.
Yeah, or a player with no experience.
Yeah.
But someone who's had a couple of games of D&D is, I think I know what role playing is. Like, it's quite alarming to throw them into that and put them on the spot. But if they've never role played before, then it's just make believe. Most people can do that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then improv, work on your improv, that's...
Yeah. Go to an improv class, buy an improv book, watch Whose Line Is It Anyway? Anything you can do which lets you understand the mechanics behind making interesting, satisfying made-up stories.
So I think one of the things I've definitely taken away from it is, I mean, I moved off D&D to Savage Worlds, which in its own worlds is fast, fun and furious. And it worked for a while, but then it stopped working. And I think it's random combat's about reason. Fighting just for having a fight, which very tempted to do a lot of systems. Half the rule book is about fighting, and obviously fights generally are kind of fun because there's always a definite peril. You can win, you can lose. But yeah, I think so, a lot of fights now, I'm kind of looking back going, well, it didn't really add much to the story, and it meant when there was an important fight, in a way, it got a bit belittled because it was a do-or-die situation rather than an entertaining moment where there could be any outcome, not just necessarily character death.
Yeah.
Other consequences, that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah, so what else did we cover? Define your baddies.
Yes.
So make the combat interesting by making them care about what's going on, and then making the people they're fighting.
Make the baddies concrete, make them exist, rather than you are fighting this orc, so it exists. Like, this is an orc with weird hair, this is an orc who said, I'm going to add you to my collection of eyes, boy. That sort of thing. Whatever. Just giving one thing which you can pin. So, I'm going to stab the eye collector rather than I'm going to stab. Hang on, which orc has the fewest hit points? Mm. Yeah, that sort of thing. Is that us?
I think. We'll use music if nothing else.
Yeah, certainly use music.
To spruce things up. You can use dialogue during combat. Make things other than just combat happening during the thing.
Cool.
Okay. Right. Hey, thanks, guys.
Thank you for calling us. Thank you for letting us on this podcast week after week.
Yeah. No, that's some great tips. We have to go away in the corner and think about all this now.
Listeners, I presume we have some sort of commenting system, but if you do have any sort of tips which you're interested in sharing, like some quick way which you can make combat interesting,
yes,
get involved. Do it. It's really exciting. Please let us know, because I'm always interested in learning more ways, and I would love to hear from you.
Yeah, check out the blog, or even just send us a comment on, on Twitter. I'm at John Solo, and Grant is...
I am at G-S-H-O-W-I-T-T, or G-Show-It, as people intentionally mispronounce.
And I'm at Phantom Whale.
Phantom Whale.
Phantom Whale.
I feel like there are other suggestions that we've missed, so please send us your suggestions or comments.
Yes.
Is there, just before we close, is there anything you guys want to call out or mention?
There's a Kickstarter. What's it called? I think it's called Blaze in the Dark. Blaze in the Dark is Kickstarter. It's ending in 12 days. It's stupidly successful. It's by the guy who did Lady Blackbird. I'm very jealous. He's made over $100,000 on this. Dollars, not pounds, but still. It's a game where, like, you play thieves in a fantasy city, and you start off and you are terrible thieves, and you get better and you build a crew, and you take over part of the city that has its own problems. Apparently it's really, really very good. I can recommend having a look at that if you like story games, if you like Lady Blackbird, if you like whatever. Very cool.
That sounds great. I hadn't heard of that. And I also hear that Goblin Quest from renowned game designer is going to be officially, the PDF is coming, isn't it?
Goblin Quest comes out next week. So the PDF will remain on sale. We're closing down, Goblin Quest I wrote, I should say. PDF will remain on sale in perpetuity, but the hard copy, that will shut that down on Monday or Tuesday for that. So that's actually coming out with all the rules hacks and everything and all the art, which is really exciting. I've had a look at the book. It's gorgeous. I can't wait for people to play it, especially Sean Bean Quest, which is a game which you play five... Each player plays five Sean Beans, and you have to try and make a film and not die until the end, which is a very strange game to have written and played.
Polish off your Yorkshire accent.
Hey, old lad. It were impressive to see how bad people were at Northern accents. all over the world, no one can do a decent Northern accent, not even me. Well, I'm legally from there.
Well, it sounded pretty convincing to me, but,
You're a foreigner, John. So, anyway, thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll bid you good night.
Oh, I have one, sorry, before we go.
Very sorry.
So, there's a Swedish RPG called Simbarum, which the art looks fantastic. I don't know how the game, the original Swedish game is, but just kind of based on that. And I think they're kind of slightly struggling on Indiegogo right now, so I think they need your help. Definitely worth checking out, just to see what that's all about.
Yeah, it looked really interesting. I'd like some more on the system, but it was it's a gorgeous looking game.
Definitely. Ben, have you got anything? You
I'm struggling to play through all the role-playing stuff I've managed to back on Kickstarter so far, although I am obviously looking forward to receiving my hardback copy of Goblin Quest.
As am I.
Absolutely. But I think a couple of the Kickstarters have actually dropped recently. One of them was a game, Forge War. So if you're into kind of Euro-style games, this one's a Euro, but it's not boring and about farming, which means it's a Euro that works for me. And this is sort of gathering your raw materials and weapon designs and sending adventurers out on quests. And that's kind of gone down very well in our group recently. We've having lots of fun with that because it's... You've got this fantasy thematic thing. The weapons all look pretty awesome and pretty fun. And there's an epic variant we tried last night, which does actually run to quite an epic playtime of around 5.5 hours. But the base game plays in 1 or 2 hours, and it's still very good. But we all thoroughly enjoyed the epic game and wish we were all 18 again so we could play it every weekend.
Cool.
And I think Kickstarter-wise, nothing huge appeared on my radar recently other than, I think... Combat-wise, the Conan, and then also Blood Rage, which was a related one, which of course had some crossover mechanics as well, so there I'm kind of looking forward to those arriving later in the year and running around as Conan and throw my axes into people's faces.
Nice.
Always fun.
Always.
Well, thanks, everyone, and thank you so much for listening. You know, check us out on the web, and I'll put links in the show notes, and we hope you've enjoyed it.
Nice. Have fun, adventurers.
Yes, have fun.
Have fun with silly voices.
With silly genetic NPC voices.
Only the silliest voices. Good day.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Goodbye. Oh.